There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Get down with you.
Now, the prank of the year. And savage it is too.
On closer inspection, a delight becomes a fright for the phone company.
I'm really disappointed about the whole thing.
Now look at this. Look carefully.
T-E-L-E-C-O-M, telecom, and S-U-X, sex.
Oh yes.
Ain't nothing to work out.
Ain't nothing to work out.
Ain't nothing to know.
Ain't nothing to know.
Ain't no way you can grow unless you let go.
Kia ora, and welcome back to Prank of the Year. Barring any massive new revelations that might come out in the future, this is where our investigation ends. If you're listening to this episode on its release day, then please join me in celebrating the 30th anniversary of our Telecom Christmas card incident. It's been exactly 3 decades since I sat in front of the TV in my childhood home and watched Paul Holmes chortle about the card with the Telecom sucks message. An event that became the catalyst for this whole weird adventure. When I was a kid, around the same time that I was watching that Paul Holmes episode, I wanted to be a detective. I knew from cartoons that detectives, they pulled magnifying glasses out of their trench coat pockets, and they followed footprints on the dirty floor to find their answers. I used to make up mysteries to solve with my little brother. 30 years later, it seems, I'm still playing detective. Before we get into the episode proper, I just want to acknowledge everyone that I somehow convinced to join me on this odyssey. Paul Holmes might have regarded the story as a quirky piece of news filler in 1993, but I've tried to treat this whole investigation seriously, for the most part, and I deeply appreciate the time, the insights, and the recollections of everyone that I've spoken to. I'm also grateful for everyone who has listened to this series, and for those who have reached out to us. Thank you all. Today's episode is going to be a bumper edition. After 5 years of investigation, dozens of interviews, hundreds of pages of historic records, and countless hours of production, it's all coming down to this. Like I said in our previous episode, I believe that my co-producer Luke and I are closer than anyone has ever been, and likely ever will be, to knowing what happened with the Telecom card. Let's start with a quick recap, because as you might recall from episode 1, memory isn't always as reliable as we'd like it to be. After I'd revisited the Holmes broadcast, I was shocked to learn that my initial assumption, that an artist had defaced his own work to stick it to Telecom, that wasn't accurate. And a closer look at Telecom's history told me that there was no shortage of people who thought they might have sucked in the early 90s. We unpacked the Otago Daily Times newspaper article at exhaustive length, and crucially, we found out as much as we could about the Telecom Art Awards exhibition, hosted at the Otago Art Society Gallery. We also dug into the scanning and printing processes that would have been used to turn a painting into a greeting card in the early 90s. Both of these are super important because they present opportunities for tampering. Last week's episode featured a bunch of experts who filled us in on the topics of marketing, art crime, protest objects, and art-based activism. These bonus conversations gave us a chance to better understand what motivates this sort of statement. And now that we're up to speed, let's pick up on the cliffhanger that we left you with in episode 4. As you'll recall, Luke and I came to the realization that we needed the perspective of one person in particular, someone with a direct link to this case. Mr. Gray Dixon, the artist who was crowned one of the Otago Region's Art Awards finalists and had his work turned into a telecom Christmas card. Gray, or Graham, was living in Dunedin in 1993, and he still lives in the southern part of New Zealand's South Island. It took us a very long time to finally track him down and open up a line of communication. Graham is a man who values his privacy. As you'll hear, he has his reasons for this, and I respect them. While we'd love to be able to drop in a crisp, clear audio interview with the man himself, Graham asked that we keep our communications to email. It was fundamentally important to me that we embark on this whole journey only with his blessing. And so over the past 12 months, that's exactly what we've done. With the information he shared with us, we've been able to get a much better understanding of what went down in December 1993. Graham has consistently denied sabotaging his own artwork, but he definitely has feelings about how Telecom conducted itself as a company back in the 90s. He was also able to clear up some, but not all, of the gaps in our knowledge. What you're about to hear are Graham's words, but we've asked an actor to read them.
I'm not sure what else I can add to the story that you haven't already gleaned from the TV items and newspapers. However, should you have any questions for me, I'll do my best to answer them for you. As to the monopoly that Telecom was then and its culture, I've attached a bio of Rod Dean, the CEO at the time, who was pulling an enormous salary whilst cutting staff and services in the name of profit. One example of this myopic focus was the axing of the free phone to Santa for kids, and that really upset a lot of the public.
Put a pin in that free phone to Santa thing. We're going to come back to it soon. Graham seemed puzzled that anyone would have any further questions about his painting, and he probably didn't expect that I had dozens of them. He was open to answering some, though, so I whittled my long list of questions down to a measly 13. Here's what he said.
As mentioned previously, there's not really much I can add to the story you already have, apart from the following. I don't know who the printers were, but there was a mess up when the painting went missing for over a week after it was sent to Wellington rather than Auckland. I never saw the painting from the evening where we all gathered in the gallery for the announcement until it was sent back to me following printing. I received the painting back from Telecom after they had finished with it. They also enclosed several of the Christmas cards for my use. I sent these cards out to friends and family. One of these friends saw the hidden message and told me. I then informed Telecom and was instructed by them to keep it all quiet. Maybe a couple of days later, Kim Hill announced to the world on her 9 to noon show, and I ended up in the media circus.
Gray concluded this email with an interesting sign-off too.
I do wish you well with your project and that Nancy will be, as she promised in The Secret of the Old Clock, to be as careful as a pussycat on a slippery roof. Kind regards, Graham.
For those of you not well versed on 20th century children's literature, Gray is referring here to Nancy Drew, the girl detective who is often advised to tread lightly as she tries to solve a mystery.
Don't worry, Nancy, I'd think up something.
Well, you better start thinking. They're right behind us.
What?
I was a little bit puzzled by this vaguely ominous sign-off, and it wasn't until several months later that I understood why Gray might have advised caution. Here's a story from another of Gray's emails.
Immediately after the media exposure, I started to receive several abusive and or threatening anonymous phone calls. There was no caller ID back then. Some of which were possibly from Telecom supporters, whilst others, from what I perceived, were angry supporters of the arts or maybe artists who relied on corporate money for their existence. It was quite harrowing at the time. Then, several weeks later, I received a surprise phone call from a man who said he was Telecom security and he wanted to visit me to talk about the painting but didn't have my address. I was a little suspicious, so I suggested I'd meet him at a specific place in my neighbourhood. I waited on the footpath where arranged, and soon after, a white Holden Commodore pulled up with two men sitting in the front. I was asked to hop in the back seat, which I did. They were both the size and shape of a family refrigerator and looked as though they'd just come straight off the set of a 60s American TV cop show. I soon lost that thought, though, when they began to use their physical presence to effect and, without mincing words, demanded I give them the painting immediately. I sat dumbstruck at first, which may have signaled to them that the intimidation was failing, because they then said that unless I gave it to them there and then, I would be in court before my feet had touched the ground. Somewhat confused and hoping to stall them until I could confirm that they were who they said they were, I told them it wasn't in my possession anymore as I'd given it away. They looked at each other, mumbling something, and then the guy in the passenger seat shrugged his square shoulders back into line and started to open his door. I immediately jumped out of the car and walked off at a good pace down the street. I turned into a neighbor's gate and looked back through their hedge. The passenger hadn't followed me, and they were now both sitting in the car talking. I stayed hidden behind the hedge until they drove off. I hope that helps in a portrayal of some of the fallout that followed me thereafter and where I sit with it.
This is wild. What the hell was going on here? Who were these goons? Were they actually on Telecom's payroll? I just can't reconcile the story. I have no earthly idea what to make of it. So let's sit with it for a minute, and pick up again after the break.
This is getting too dangerous for you. We're going home and you're going to keep out of the whole affair while you're in one piece.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hours before I sat down to record this episode, an email from Gray landed in our inbox, and the content of it made us frantically rewrite most of what you're about to hear. Graham had been doing some spring cleaning that very day, and while rifling through a, quote, bulging file cabinet, he came across a manila envelope marked Telecom. Inside this folder was correspondence from late 1993 between himself, Telecom's head office in Wellington, and Telecom Directories, the Auckland-based subsidiary that produced phone books. He sent us pictures of all these letters, faxes, and handwritten notes, and they weave quite a story. I will say right now that we didn't have a definitive answer to this entire mystery before we got Graham's cache of documents, and we don't have one afterwards either. Later in the episode, you'll hear Luke and I go through all of the theories about what might have happened, but first, we need to lay some groundwork, and that involves building a timeline. I believe that this sequence of events is the most comprehensive account of the Telecom card incident that exists. As always, if anyone listening to this has any knowledge that can help us fill any gaps, we'd love to hear it. I've drawn from primary sources, such as newspaper and other media coverage, remembered accounts of people that we've heard from during previous episodes, and information that Gray Dixon has clarified with us by email, including the most recent documents that he's unearthed. So let's jump in. I'll try not to make this too dense. In February 1993, Telecom announced that it had made a record $121 million profit the previous quarter. At the same time, they also announced plans for a significant restructure that would see over 5,200 staff redundancies within the next 4 years. In the following months, Gray Dixon takes up painting as a hobby, and there's a good chance that the defaced painting was one of the first paintings he ever produced. A Radio New Zealand bulletin from early August 1993 confirms that Telecom was ordered to remove barriers on their infrastructure, making it easier for Clear Communications customers to have cheaper phone calls. This would have been done begrudgingly, I'd imagine. Remember the Santa line thing that I asked you to put a pin in? Turns out this was yet another thing that raised the public's ire towards Telecom. We know from a 3 News clip the company announced that it was discontinuing its popular service, which saw thousands of Kiwi kids ring a toll-free number and have a chat with the big man up at the North Pole.
Telecom withdrew their 0800 Santa line a few weeks ago and said they'd give the thousands of dollars saved to Women's Refuge and the Salvation Army instead. After an outcry from kiddies and parents, Santa line is back and some money still goes to charity.
One of the documents that Grace sent us was a copy of the Art Awards entry form from 1993. This was similar to the 1991 version from the Hocken Library that we'd seen, but clarified a lot of the dates that we'd previously had question marks around. For example, we now know that submissions for the 93 competition had to be in before Tuesday the 28th of September. Graham would have submitted his painting sometime in the days or weeks prior to this date. At the end of that week, on Friday the 1st of October, Graham has sent a letter from Telecom Directories. The letter, signed by a communications executive, congratulates him on being selected as one of the 20 Otago finalists out of the total 208 submissions. He is also invited to the awards ceremony, which is to be held a couple of weeks later, on Tuesday the 19th of October. In episode 3, we speculated that the two-week exhibition at the Otago Art Society could have been between the 18th and the 31st of October, and it turns out that we weren't that far off. The exhibit actually opened on Wednesday the 20th of October, the day after the awards ceremony, and it closed on Sunday the 31st. Which brings us to November. Sequence gets a little messy here. Our primary source for this was the ODT article, but subsequent correspondence with Gray has corrected a couple of points from that initial reporting. What we know for sure is that artworks that were on display were available to pick up from the 1st of November. This was stated on the entry form. A handwritten note on the form that Gray has kept indicates that he dropped by to pick it up on Wednesday the 3rd of November, but it wasn't at the gallery. That same day, a letter from the Telecom head office in Wellington is sent, signed by someone on the corporate communications team. The letter seeks his permission to use the painting on the cover of their Christmas card, and offers the sum of $350 for the right to reproduce the artwork. Gray responds with a yes, and asks for some cards to be sent when the painting is returned. A few days later, on Monday the 8th of November, Graham is sent a follow-up letter from Wellington. This letter advises that a courier has been arranged to pick up the painting from the Otago Art Society Gallery, and that Telecom will need to keep the painting for about 2 weeks while the cards are being produced. Things start to get even murkier here, so stick with me. We know that at some point during this week or so, there was some back and forth between Telecom and Gray about where the painting was, which he didn't know. A few days later, Telecom apparently called back to advise that the painting had been located in Auckland. According to the Otago Daily Times article, the painting then finds its way back to Wellington, where an unknown printing company produces the Christmas cards. If you remember from episode 4, the scanning process was often outsourced during a commercial print run, as not every printing firm even had a scanner in the 90s. Could it be that the painting was in Auckland to get scanned, before a Wellington company did the actual printing? Whatever the case, the printing happened sometime in mid to late November. A letter sent to Gray on Friday the 19th of November from Telecom head office in Wellington clarifies that, quote, the cards are now in production and should be ready by the 26th of November. The letter also promises that a $350 check and some copies of the card will be couriered back along with the painting very soon. We don't know for sure when the painting arrived back at Gray's doorstep, but we do know that it did come with some copies of the Christmas cards, and that he showed these off to friends and whānau. The friend who spotted the alterations would most likely have done so in the second week of December. How do we know this? Because Graham wrote and sent a letter, by fax, to the head of Telecom Directories on Monday the 13th of December, alerting them to the discovery. The handwritten letter explains the nature of the defacement, along with the details of Gray's interactions with various Telecom staff in the preceding months. Gray closes his letter with his concerns about the impact of the incident. Quote, I realise how delicate Telecom's public image is, and how recently it was further damaged by the inconstant handling of the Phone Santa debacle. Similarly, the original painting is now of questionable value, as is my character. The following day, Tuesday the 14th of December, Gray has sent a letter from the top brass at Telecom Directories, acknowledging that they share his concerns, and that the customer communications manager at Telecom's head office in Wellington will be in touch to respond. A handwritten note indicates that Gray received that letter at 8 a.m. the next day, Wednesday the 15th of December. Gray told us by email that this communications manager phoned him soon after they received his letter. And this probably happened on the 15th as well. He didn't record the call, but he remembers that
she rang immediately, but her style of questioning left me feeling as though they were expecting to be dealing with some sort of blackmail con. The questions were quite leading, such as, "What do you want out of this, Mr. Dixon?" I just said I thought they should know about it. As if one person had seen it, then there would be a chance others would. This kind of cat and mouse talk went on until suddenly I was not talking to anymore, but to a man who didn't identify himself, who said, and I'm paraphrasing here, "It seems unlikely anyone will notice it, as it's not that obvious, so I suggest you don't say anything and we'll hope for the best." He then asked me to send the painting back to them so they could fix it for me. I said I didn't have it, which was true at the time. My real reluctance to give them the painting was more about the lack of faith I had in their care of it, as had been demonstrated already, but more so the way that they made me feel like a criminal with their line of questioning.
On Thursday the 16th of December, Gray has sent another letter from the external communications manager at Telecom Directories, not the customer communications manager at Telecom head office who had called him. This letter thanked Gray for bringing the matter to their attention so promptly, and offers a heartfelt apology of the incident. Quote, "Please rest assured that this unfortunate incident in no way reflects badly upon you. To the contrary, we appreciate how disappointed you must feel. You are in no way responsible for what happened to your painting while it was in our care, and I am prepared to communicate this most strongly if it was ever raised with me." Perhaps naively, the letter goes on to repeat the sentiment of the unidentified second voice from Gray's earlier phone call. Quote, "After viewing the Christmas card, I do believe it requires extremely close scrutiny to identify the offending matter, so the likelihood of many people becoming aware of it is minimised somewhat." As we're now well aware, this ignore it and maybe it'll go away strategy backfired. It's not clear exactly how, but less than a week later, the story was swirling all over New Zealand media. As Gray told us,
maybe a couple of days later, Kim Hill announced to the world on her 9 to noon show, and I ended up in the media circus.
Kim Hill is a titan of New Zealand broadcasting. As I write this, she's only recently retired, after spending nearly 40 years behind a mic. The 9 to noon show that she used to front still runs on Radio New Zealand, the government-funded but editorially independent national broadcaster. I reached out to RNZ to see if they could verify the content of their bulletins around that time, but they didn't have any surviving records. I couldn't find anything in the Ngā Taonga archive either, and I wasn't going to bother the recently retired Kim Hill on the off chance that she remembered covering it. If the story was broken on the 9 to noon show, it would have been either on the 21st or 22nd of December 1993. Most likely it would have been Wednesday the 22nd, the same day that Paul Holmes closed out his 6:30 p.m. show with the story I know all too well at this point. Other TV news shows covered the story that night too. We've seen a clip from TV3 News, as well as one from another TVNZ current affairs show called Primetime. On Wednesday the 22nd, in between the 9 to noon bulletin that morning and the Holmes show at 6:30 p.m, Gray Dixon was fielding calls from media across the country. One of these calls was from Lee Harris, a writer at the Otago Daily Times newspaper, whose article graced the front page on Thursday the 23rd of December. This is the article we discussed at length in episodes 3 and 4. The New Zealand Herald article, which we looked at in episode 2, was also published that day. And this is about the point where the media coverage runs cold. We couldn't find any mention of the Telecom Sucks incident in any news media beyond the 23rd of December. Seemingly, everyone who saw the coverage of it had a chuckle and then sat back to enjoy their Christmas and forget about it. Details of the post-Christmas sequence of events are even more sparse. Here, we only really have what Graham has told us as a primary source. According to Graham's account, he started receiving threatening and abusive phone calls about the painting, quote, immediately after the media exposure, which presumably means in the days following the 22nd of December. I can't speak for Graham, but that kind of interaction from anonymous callers, it definitely would have ruined my festive mood. And of course, as we've heard, this intimidation culminated with a visit from so-called telecom security goons, who tried to strong-arm him into handing over the painting several weeks after Christmas. Before we finish up with the timeline, there's one more thing to close the loop on. Much of the news coverage that we've seen mentions that Gray was planning to auction the painting as a charity fundraiser.
Somebody made a donation to Women's Refuge, then I would gladly pass the painting on to them, and we might get something nice out of this event.
All Gray needs now is an auctioneer to do the honours in selling the telecom Christmas card with a difference.
I spent a decent chunk of time learning how charity art auctions worked 30 years ago, and a shout out to Richard and the team at the International Art Centre in Parnell for their help with this one. Once I'd made contact with Gray, I asked him about it, and alas, it turns out that the Telecom Sucks painting, it never went under the hammer.
The painting was never auctioned, but the bad publicity did see Telecom increase their support to Women's Refuge, and Free Phone for Santa was reinstated. I also understand a new job was created at Telecom for someone to check future paintings.
Then, in a simple 9-word sentence, Gray Dixon delivered an absolutely devastating final blow, violently closing the lid on a question that I badly wanted an answer to.
I have no idea where the painting is currently.
So here we are, the final act. If this was a true crime story where the mystery had been solved, we'd spend some time now teasing it out for as long as possible, before detailing exactly what happened, who was involved, and what they did. But this is not that kind of true crime story. So here's what's going to happen. Before we recorded anything for this episode, Luke and I sat down one final time to review everything, top to bottom. We went through all of the theories, from the far-fetched to the more probable, and we tried to weigh up the evidence for and against each of them. Here are our conversations about these theories, in no particular order.
How do you want to do this?
All right. Well, I mean, I thought just we've got a ton of these theories, and I wondered if a way to do this was potentially to look at each of these theories in turn and see what evidence is there that stacks up and what evidence is there that, you know, could more or less be discounted.
I guess we've got our list of possibilities here. Let's start with the one we have the least information about. Let's talk about it as being an inside job.
Okay. So this would be an inside job within telecom. So it's a disgruntled telecom worker had defaced the painting when the painting was in the care of telecom.
And it's definitely the one we learned least about because telecom was so tight-lipped about releasing what their internal investigation was. It's a real sort of dead zone in terms of information.
But effectively, it would have been in telecom's care for a couple of weeks from about the 8th or the 9th of November up until the 26th at the latest.
So that's a nearly 3-week period that some of which it was unaccounted for, a lot of which it was definitely travelling.
We know from a letter that was sent to Gray on the 19th of November that the cards were in production at that stage and that they were likely to be finished by the 26th.
Here's where we start to make some kind of inference. If we're talking about a disgruntled telecom employee at some level of the delivery chain, The thing that stands out to me that we haven't talked about much is that the messaging on there is telecom sucks. This seems really juvenile for someone who's genuinely angry, does it not?
Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, if you were disgruntled enough to, you know, to deface a painting, you might use stronger language, perhaps.
Yeah, why would you not just say fuck telecom?
The other wrinkle to this is that all of the letters that Gray received were either from Telecom Corporate, which has its head office in Wellington, or it was from Telecom Directories, which is the subsidiary, right? And they were based in Auckland.
Yep.
So I wonder if it sort of went from, you know, if the Directories team who ran the art awards arranged the courier and then it got sent to Directories and then got forwarded on to Telecom in Wellington.
We know from multiple people, but that Telecom took possession of winning entries. And we know from CAF that the actual contests and exhibitions were run by directories. So I think it's very reasonable to assume that anything that Telecom was going to process into future marketing collateral was going to be directory's responsibility to deliver to whatever the next step was. I think that's a fair assumption, yeah?
I'm just wondering if the, you know, I'm just wondering, we talk about, you know, whether it was a disgruntled Telecom worker, you know, perhaps potentially, was it a disgruntled Telecom directory's employee?
Well, and that's interesting because, again, back to Kath's interview, she talks about directories being a really good employer and not having to deal with a lot of the issues that Telecom had to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it is most likely that the vandalism occurred within Telecom rather than within Telecom directories, who were separate companies.
So what is the what's the evidence for this theory then, that it was a disgruntled Telecom worker?
You may well have lost your job, be in fear for your job, lost several co-workers, been shuffled around because departments were, you know, no longer being maintained, or in the case of a lot of departments in Telecom, like as we heard in episode two, you might be overworked. You might now be in an understaffed department where you're being expected to do work that isn't a new job description and is in excess of your available hours.
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, we all know those things. We know that Telecom's media response was certainly to shut it down, even after, you know, this went public on television news. This went as mainstream as domestic news gets. They still were incredibly tight-lipped, which, you know, is would that be the case if they were able to identify a partner company who'd been the perpetrators?
The other thing that I came back to, and we talked about this in the episode where we covered it, but, you know, just the very specific wording, you know, none of our employees was involved in it. You know, could it be that employee that was on their way out a month earlier did it? And their statement, none of our employees, you know, is technically accurate. That's the other thing as well.
I'm less compelled by that, I think, than you are, but
sure.
It is a solid point.
All right. Well, is there any evidence that says that goes against this being an inside job?
Having the materials on hand to do a convincing job. I don't know if that's something that, you know, paints it as a crime of convenience. I think there has to be some premeditation. So who would have had access to it for long enough to premeditate?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we haven't seen the painting, but we do know from, I guess, from the ODT article in particular, that the message was painted on there, which implies that it's with paints and probably a similar kind of tone and pigment and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, shall we move on to talk about the gallery then?
Yes, let's talk about the gallery because, like you said, if this was defaced with paint, more likely to be paint lying around in the gallery, right?
Look, I think the idea of someone, and I don't want to discount it immediately, but I think the idea of someone on staff at an art gallery, especially since they were mostly volunteers, wanting to deface a work of art, no matter how much they hate Telecom, they know they're going after an artist's work. They, more than anyone, can appreciate that there's an uninvolved human here who, you know, has creative collateral you're destroying.
And I guess, too, there's, you know, there's the reputational damage with Telecom. I mean, Telecom would have been a fairly regular, you know, exhibitor at their space. You know, they probably charged Telecom to use their space. And, you know, if you damage that relationship, that's not good for future events.
Part of the problem with the gallery as well is that the defacement is upside down. And at the gallery, directories and comes in and hangs those paintings. Which means that not only was the thing defaced, but it was taken down and defaced, which just seems not only risky, but why would you not just deface it on the wall and write the right way up, you know?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. The ODT article did go into consider the gallery a fair bit. They mentioned that it had been on display for 2 weeks and that someone at the gallery had said that the gallery was supervised during the day while the exhibitions are on, but it was often rented out at night, which implies that, you know, potentially that was a theory that someone who had rented the space for an event in an evening during that time might have done it.
Yeah, and when we were looking at the map, it's definitely there's good access to public thoroughfares in terms of the main entrance and in terms of that rented out event space.
So evidence for it happened at the gallery is that there was potentially opportunity, you know, because it wasn't supervised 100% of the time.
There's definitely a degree of motive in that Telecom had alienated the public. And you've got to believe that anyone laid off by Telecom is also a member of the public and his family are members of the public. So that motivation also trickles down.
Yeah, Telecom had a service center or, you know, an office in Dunedin. So there's a good chance that some of those employees might have been let go.
It's a contender. Why are we both leaning away from it?
It just seems weird. You know, I can't really describe it beyond that. It just seems like a weird thing to do.
The obvious act of rebellion here is getting the vandalism onto a card. And no one who had access to that gallery space had any knowledge that that painting was going anywhere near Telecom's marketing collateral.
That's exactly right. The exhibition was done and dusted by the time...
Yeah, by the time they announced that it was going to be printed or reproduced in any kind of way.
Yeah. All right.
Well, shall we talk a little bit about interference from the rest of the telecommunications industry then?
And I mean, and this is something that Phoebe sort of talked us through. This was one of her kind of things that she was speculating on, is was it somehow executed by Clear?
Well, Clear is, you know, Clear's branding at the time was, in Phoebe's terms, a challenger brand. Mm-hmm. So being very focused on going after the monopolistic Telecom in the public eye is in keeping with how they approach their marketing.
Is the fact that the Clear logo is on there, does that necessarily point to Clear being involved?
I would say not necessarily at all, because we still come up against the fact that Telecom had possession of the painting before anyone decided it was going to get eyes on it within their marketing. Mm-hmm. So what it would presume is that Clear had someone within Telecom who was willing to do that for them.
Yeah.
Which isn't impossible. It's very corporate espionage-y, but we know corporate espionage happens.
Yeah. Does it happen for this kind of thing, though?
Well, here's the thing that makes it a little more compelling, is we don't know who leaked this to major news organizations. And we know...
That's true.
We know Telecom would have been very, very anti this getting out and would have been wielding every tool they had at their disposal once they knew, because Telecom knew before the news did.
Yeah. And, I mean, we even have... You know, we don't have it written down anywhere, but we know from Gray's recollections that they had, what's the term?
They'd been quite emphatic about keeping this secret.
Yeah.
And we do have it in writing, but they felt that it wouldn't be noticed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, in their apology letter.
So if this had been a premeditated marketing attack by Clear, then they would absolutely want it to get out. They would absolutely be, you know, all about leaking it to the news.
It is possible. I mean, if it was done covertly and it didn't get found out, then it's genius. But if it got found out, then it's very risky reputationally.
So is this a good opportunity to discuss the other thing that came up during our interviews that we didn't really find an opportunity to cut in? Mm-hmm. And that's to talk about the arts community as a form of industry interference.
Yeah, right. Because that was something that we learned from Linda Tyler. And yeah, she she sort of said that, you know, within the arts community, there were mixed feelings about the Telecom Art Awards.
It was leveling the playing field for people who didn't depend on art for their income. Look, we couldn't fit it in episode 3, but we'll pull down the audio now.
They felt anybody could win it, a baby could win it, and it deprofessionalised art practice. If it's something that you see all the time on the cover of a phone book or something, then, and it's living in your room, then it becomes the Mona Lisa. You know, it becomes much better than it might ordinarily be if it was put in amongst, you know, the cultural productions of professional artists for that particular year.
What do we think of this theory? I mean, is this a legitimate theory that a member?
I think
of the
it was interesting and it was worth talking about because it's not something we had the opportunity to bring up elsewhere, and it is an interesting point. But I don't think it's a legitimate theory.
No. What other theories do we have then?
It kind of brings us to print, right?
Yeah. So the theory that we've heard, you know, the people that we've asked to speculate, you know, a few of them have brought up the fact that it could have been done at the printers. And I think Stephanie, who we heard in episode 5, she sort of said that, you know, she wouldn't be surprised if some people in the printing industry had an activist bent. What I said to Brian at SCG when we spoke to him, and this remains true, is that the fact that it was the original painting that was defaced, what that means is that whoever scanned the image, they would have been the last person that could have defaced it.
And honestly, they were probably the only person who actually people who actually handled it. There's no reason for someone printing a card to handle the painting it was scanned from.
Yeah. And that's not to say that, you know, the scanning and the printing didn't happen at the same place. It just, you know, I feel like this is the biggest missing piece of the puzzle, is where the cards were printed. Because if we knew that, we might be able to find out, okay, did they have a scanner at the time? Was it scanned on site? Was it scanned somewhere else, potentially in Auckland?
Yeah.
So that's the biggest missing piece.
The vandalism at that stage is pretty easy in terms of having materials around. That's a big check. Mm-hmm. In terms of having the opportunity to premeditate, that's absolutely a check. Mm-hmm. It's probably with the scanner for a few days before they get around to it.
Yep.
In terms of knowing how to subtly mark an object, that's another big check. And in terms of being, you know, alone with the painting and knowing that it was bound for distribution by Telecom's marketing, another big check.
Yeah, I mean it's a good theory.
Well, there are two big downsides, though. Two very big downsides. The first is, why not mark up the plate? Why mark up the painting? Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest objection is that the scanner was probably one individual, which means if this is discovered, it's so easy to point the finger.
Mm.
It's high risk.
Yeah, and I mean, let's not forget, too, that Telecom would have been a huge customer for the printing house or the, you know, and or the scanning house that... Yeah, so it'd be reputational risk as well if it was discovered. You know, we know from Tom and even from Phoebe that something like that would have gone through a significant sign-off process. You know, they would have had more than one person at Telecom checking it and giving it the okay before it went into production. The only counter-argument to that is that there is plausible deniability. If it was discovered, and Telecom came back to the printers and said, hey, what did you do to this painting? Then there is plausible deniability for them to sort of sit back and go, oh, well, shit, that wasn't us. We didn't even notice that. Must have been the artist or something like that. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think the printing theory is a strong one. Do you agree?
I do. I think of all of the places that it could have happened, it's high on my list. But it's a huge risk that someone took for next to no gain.
That's the other thing too, is that, you know, if you were motivated to do this, what benefit would there be?
The only suspect anywhere on our list that has anything to truly gain by this is the least likely suspect, is our big outlier, it's clear. And then, of course, there's the most obvious one to discuss, that it was in the artwork from day one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if it's the most obvious, but it's definitely one that's been talked about.
You know, it's definitely what telecom felt happened.
Yeah. And yeah, that Grey Dixon did it himself.
And I mean, if Grey Dixon did it himself, he's literally the only person in this entire investigation who did nothing wrong, because that's free artistic expression. And if Telecom wants to print it on their cards, that's their problem.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah, the onus would have been on them to scrutinize the artwork more carefully, perhaps.
And, up until we started really talking to Grey, I would have made the same assumption, I think. It's just a clean, yeah, tidy theory.
Yeah, I mean, Occam's razor, it does make sense.
Yeah.
I don't buy this theory at all, though.
Nor do I. Not for a second. Not anymore.
No. And the reason I don't buy this theory is because he told them about it. he is the one who, and we have his letter that he sent on the 13th of December, you know, shortly after his friend noticed the hidden message in there. He's the one that advised them and laid it all out.
Yes, and tried to keep it quiet.
Yeah.
That's not the action of someone who's about to whistleblow it. That's not the action of someone who is looking to publicize this stuff. And the other thing is, he has been so consistent in his messaging.
Yeah.
Both in the reporting of the time and in communicating with us, nothing has changed.
And I think the fact that, you know, we have the letter from Telecom, you know, after it had all been investigated and discussed, you know, we have the letter from, this one's from Telecom Directories, and basically, you know, basically lays it all out and says, you know, this, you know, thanks for bringing it to our attention. Please rest assured this in no way reflects badly on you. You know, you have the full support of the Telecom Corporation. You know, it's.
Yeah, and his initial concern when he contacts them in a private letter that we're privy to because he shared it with us is reputational damage to himself.
Yeah.
It's not the primary concern of someone who put out a work and to defame a company and made them distribute it.
Yeah. The other big point against this is that when he produced the painting, which is one of his first, and submitted it for the Art Awards, he had no idea that A, it was going to become a finalist,
yep,
B, that it was going to become a Christmas card, and C, that it was going to get all this media attention.
We know from our communications with him, he wasn't a fan of Telecom. Whether that is something that came about after the events that he experienced or was pre-existing, I don't know. But he has motive, he has the best opportunity, and he has the lowest risk. All of those things stack up to make him a good candidate, but his conduct just doesn't fit. So after all of this, what is our definitive scenario of what we believe happened? Give me just your best guess.
My best guess is that a Telecom employee who was on their way out the door, maybe they'd already received their redundancy letter, working at either Telecom Directories or Telecom Head Office, most likely Telecom Head Office, had the opportunity to be in a room with the painting unsupervised for a time and decided to stick it to Telecom.
Yep, I think that's the most plausible scenario. Based on what we know.
Anyone who receives a Christmas gift from me can easily tell whether I've wrapped it myself or if it was done by one of those people in a mall kiosk. When it comes to this mystery, I'd love to be able to wrap it up neatly with crisply folded paper, silky ribbon, and a pretty little bow on the top. But that's not possible right now. Despite our best efforts, this mystery, as of today at least, remains unsolved. We don't know with any certainty who defaced the painting, what motivated them to do it, or how they went about it. Is that unsatisfying? Sure it is, on some level. It's in our nature to seek out answers to the things we don't know, and to feel frustration when those answers aren't forthcoming. But the more I reflect on this whole strange journey, the more I feel at peace with the whole not knowing. My goal with this project was to pick up a dangling thread from my memory banks, tug at it, and then see how far it went. I've spent much of the past 5 years fine-tooth combing through research material and talking to fascinating people about the things that they're fascinated by. I've sent hundreds of emails, and I've learned about entire industries that I had no prior interest in. And around 12 months ago, I began the process of distilling everything swirling around in my brain into some half-hour podcast episodes. As we've heard throughout this series, the people who don't know about or don't remember the Telecom Sucks incident, they vastly outnumber the people who do. Even now, as I record these final thoughts, I can safely count the people I know who do recall it on one hand. But I do feel a sense of satisfaction in being able to share this weird memory with people literally all over the world. Sitting here now, I've decided to give myself the gift of closure this Christmas. I don't want to shut the door on the story completely, but rather keep it slightly ajar, just in case any new information comes to light. If you do know anything, we're still very keen to hear from you. And of course, if any huge revelations come up, we'll be back with more episodes. But until then, I'm going to remain content with not knowing.
If I knew that tomorrow would be the last day that I live.
On the next episode of Prank of the Year, well, that's kind of up to you. Craig and I are pretty confident we've found out everything we can, so this is probably the end of our story. But if by some miracle someone who hears this knows something we don't, then maybe there'll be more episodes. If you're that someone, or know someone who might be, then flick us an email at telecomsucks1993, or one word, at gmail.com. We can even keep you anonymous if that's what you want. Finally, if you've enjoyed going on this journey with us, then consider leaving a rating and a review. It really does make a difference.
Prank of the Year is written and produced by Luke Watkinson and me, Craig Major. We couldn't have made this show without the support of so many people and organisations. Folks we've interviewed, asked weird questions to, and relied on for their insights, recollections and guidance. These include Professor Marion Gary, Nga Tonga Sound and Vision, Rochelle Lockley, Keith Newman, Dr. Chris Galloway, Jan Lipsky, Warwick Thorley, Roland and Simon at MOTAT, Grant Forsyth, Lee Harris, Ellis at Dunedin Libraries, Mary Burgess, Rata at the Alexander Turnbull Library, Kath Blanahassett, Professor Linda Tyler, Charlie at Tuhuru Otago Museum, the team at Hocken Library, Bruce Sargent, Christine Lockett, Ruth Cobb at Print NZ, Brian Landry, Tom, the Yellow Pages apprentice, Spark NZ, Dr. Phoebe Fletcher, Penelope Jackson, Stephanie Gibson and the team at Te Papa Tongarewa, Chris McBride, and Rachel Sorensen. The voices you heard in the series were Alexander Jones, Maddie Mitchell, Terry Hoban, Nicola Peppercorn, Nancy Lamb, and Richard Martin. Music in this series was courtesy of Kong Fui, Deluxe Boy, Carlisle Laurent, Flute, Vlad Glushenko, and Kevin McLeod. Special thanks go to Ryan Wolf at Brevity Studios, Media Design School, our friends in whānau, including Ruth and Lillian, our research assistants, and finally, Graham Gray Dixon.
Is there anything else we want to get?
Yeah, look, we started this series talking about not a crime, but a memory.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first scripted episode one, you talked about maybe being drawn to this because an act of rebellion spoke to you as a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean to you now?
For so long, there's always been extra stuff that we could look into. It's, oh, well, what about that? Or what about this part of it? Or can we find any information about X, Y, Z? There's always been something else to look at. And I think that we've found everything that there is to find. And I think that there's, if there is nothing more to discover, if this is all there is to know about this situation, about this incident, then I think I'm okay with that. I mean, if anyone that was involved in this is, you know, taking this to their grave or has already taken this to their grave, and we will never know, then I feel like we've uncovered something that virtually nobody remembers, and we've shone a light on it, and I think that's cool. And I think that what appealed to me as a kid was that the idea that a big company had asked somebody to make a paint, you know, to do some artwork for them, and they had basically given the fingers to that company in a really subtle way. Okay, I really like that. It was like this tiny little act of rebellion that didn't get immediately noticed. And I think those tiny acts of rebellion are important. And, you know, 30 years later, you know, I'm not going to get into it too much, but there's stuff happening in the world which I think needs to be called out, and there's institutions that need to be made fun of. And I think that if we can pull this example out of the dustbin of history, where it wasn't even a footnote, you know, nobody knew about this. Everyone had forgotten about this, pretty much. If we can pull this out and present this to the world as something that did happen 30 years ago, however it happened, or for whatever motivated it, I think that's an important story to tell.
Well said. So I suppose we need to say a huge thank you to the Telecom Vandal, whoever you are, because you've given us a vehicle to foster the spirit of rebellion in whoever happens to come across this.
Yeah.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.